two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to take some different angles to look at the Derek Chauvin trial as we're seeking justice for George Floyd. Looking at the impact that race is obviously having, not only on how people view this trial, but just the conditions that have led up to the horrific killing of George Floyd and countless others at the hands of police. And so I wanted to invite on the show Steve Martino. He's an instructor emeritus at the Center of Interdisciplinary Program at SF State. He's the author of a number of books, including The Rules of Racialization, Class Identity, Governments, Forms in the Abyss, A Philosophical Bridge Between Sartre and Derrida. I hope I didn't butcher that at. And then we also have The Machinery of Whiteness. He has a number of articles that deal with race and police force and use of force, et cetera, et cetera. So welcome to the show, Steve. And I want to start off with a simple question. When we talk about race and how it's impacting, in this case, the way that folks are engaging or perceiving the police, what do you think is missing in the dominant narratives that come across, you know, the airwaves for you or just in general conversation? What do you think we're missing when we talk about these topics?
Well, I mean, I would say that we're missing the people. When we hear about police and police activities and police brutality, we are hearing about what they do from their perspective, which is in their language and is in terms of what I call police culture. Mm. And they have a separation. They have developed a separation from the ethics and the ethos of civilian society, from civil society, that is based upon what I call a culture of contempt, a commanding officer paradigm in which they feel that they can give anybody a command and have it instantly obeyed. And that they demand obedience and obeisance to who they are and what they are doing. And this would all become, I think, evident to any reporter who looked into the events of police brutality and did an investigation of what is going on in the event or behind it. And reported on that, if there was investigative reportage about these events. And of course, you know, like the murder of George Floyd is, you know, like paradigmatic, but you know, like even Kayla Moore or some of the other acts of violence against people in the streets of Berkeley, where, you know, somebody doesn't die, but they get hurt, are also part of that, that all this would, you know, like become part of the way we understand what we're facing. And it's not being done. We need reportage that will bring all this out so that we, the people, can begin to say, hey, wait a minute now. What kind of police force do we need or do we want? And what is it that would, you know, really serve our interests as people in the street and needing safety and protection?
That sounds ideal. But, yes. You know, looking at some of your writings, to do that would really mean jettisoning a big part of people's identity. Would you not agree that, you know, to look at the police and see them in a way that is, that puts them in a less powerful position for many folks, that would be something that is kind of, woo, I lose a little bit of myself, meaning maybe not Black folks who I think have long had an adversarial relationship, but there are some that, you know, the authoritarianism of the police is something that is embedded in the fabric of this country and maybe embedded in the fabric of how many people think. Would I be off base in seeing it that way?
No, I don't think so. I think that what you're raising is indeed embedded deep down inside the culture of this country. And I'm saying that that needs to be changed because it kills. There, you know, like the current statistic is that, you know, like the police are killing about 1,100 people every year, which comes out to around 3 a day. That's a lot. I mean, for a government, and the police are part of the government, to be killing its own people at that rate is absurd. It's outrageous. So, you know, like, we have to take a look at this and say, yes, you're right. There is something deep inside the culture that that we have learned to live with all our lives, and it's coming home to roost right now because we have all of these present circumstances and incidents that come out on video now because everybody's got a video camera, and we're all of a sudden learning something. We're learning something about who we are. We're learning something about how this country runs. And confronting it means we can't just say, oh, okay, that's the way things are. That's not good enough. And, you know, you can say, okay, I have an ideal. I can present an ideal about, you know, like what we might be able to do. That's what you always have to start with. If you'll take a look at a situation and you say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. What do you start with? You start with an ideal. You start with, well, how would this look if it was better? What would a better way of being be?
Are we at that point where we can do that now? If so, what's the path to that? And I ask that knowing that we saw 70 million people vote for somebody who was an avowed, unapologetic racist. We saw a lot of people who are gaslighting us and gaslighting themselves with what we saw on January 6th with this attempted insurrection at the White House. We're also looking at, you know, the continued propaganda, or some people call copaganda, that comes across our TV sets, our TV screens every night in the form of reality shows and very well produced. You know, some of these dramas I actually like, you know, the Law and Order type of shows, the NYPD Blues, and, you know, there's probably more cop shows than any other show, you know, that comes on that eventually seep into the psyche and inform us. So what steps would you take aside from maybe getting some investigative reporting, but are there maybe some psychological things that we can do to start breaking down this dependency on a narrative and a way of being that obviously, as you said, leads to death of 1,100 people a year at the very least?
Well, now you're getting down to what we're really facing, and that is white supremacy. We have this former president who was, you know, like openly avowing and abetting the development of white supremacist thinking and organizations in this society. And but that's always been there. I mean, this country was built upon it back when, you know, like people of color were enslaved. African Americans were enslaved. And then after slavery was abolished, they invented a substitute for it called Jim Crow. And it took another 60 years or whatever before, you know, like that could be thrown out as being, you know, against the ethics that we assume, you know, like are contained in the Constitution. All right. Well, that's still there. And it came back as a response to the fact that there was actually a black man elected president. And people started to reorganize a response and an objection to the fact that, you know, like black people seem to, you know, like be gaining that their equality after, you know, like 200 years of being held down. And so, you know, like there's an ethos. It's a cultural foundation that has to be addressed and has to be undone. Now, we have theories of how to change the class structure of a society, but we don't have any theories of how to change a cultural structure. So we are in the present moment with that necessity right now. We saw some of it happen with the civil rights movements during the 60s and 70s, when you had thousands and thousands of black people marching in the streets and saying, stop this. We are people, human beings equal to you. And for a lot of white people, that called into question their identity, and it was a good thing. It was a good thing that it called into question their identity. There's nothing about an identity that is sacrosanct. It has to have a certain ethic. It has to have a certain, you know, like morality. Okay. After the Reagan administration, a lot of this was taken back. And so now we are faced with a situation in which, you know, like there are two sides that are practically equal. You have the white vote for Trump, and you have the diverse vote for Biden, and you have a virtual civil war going on between these two factions for control of the White House, which, you know, like can go either way. I know a lot of people who are actually very happy with what Biden is doing because he's moving toward a more populist kind of policy rather than toward the right, as a lot of people expected him to do.
Right.
But I mean, you know, like it's calling the question. And, you know, like people say, oh, well, you know, like, what's his name? Trump is going to come along with his big lie that he won the election. But what they're missing is that what he's saying about it from his perspective is not a lie, because he's only counting white votes. If you only count white votes, then he won the election and he won by a landslide.
Right.
That's not the way this country runs. That's not the way a diverse society runs. He wants it to run that way. We who have a better understanding and a more democratic approach to humans don't. Okay,
right.
That's where we're at. This is the moment we're in, and this is the question that this moment is calling for us.
Well, it's interesting. What it sounds like you're saying is we're talking about somebody who is continuing the dehumanization of a population of people. In this case, black folks, brown folks, that diverse community that you talk about. But we should simultaneously, Steve, in my opinion, be concerned that so many white folks are voting to the point that he feels that he won the majority of white folks. And that seems to be the crux of the problem, that the majority of white people in this country have not only voted for him, but have, you know, at the same time gotten behind policies in about 30, 40 states that would further our dehumanization, at least politically speaking, you know, hindering our rights to vote, hindering our opportunities to advance, all these types of things. And so we're still left with that conundrum to the degree that even if we can look and see a day where whites are not the majority, there's still a significant number of folks that are able to run the ship. And it's complicated because we have some very elite folks, a 1% class, if you will, that seems to be orchestrating this. You talked about maybe reporting should be more investigative and really bring to the forefront some of the things that you mentioned. But we know that many of these outlets actually stoke the fires. It gets them paid. It gets them clicks and views. And it also seems to, you know, actually fit in their philosophy, you know, to be quite honest, that some of these folks, they may be in the Bay Area and working in Silicon Valley, but they actually feel this way. And this is a form of power that they're able to exercise. So we're still left with, you know, that big elephant in the room that so many people really like the status quo at the end of the day.
Well, okay. I'm not going to make the same assumption that you are, that white people always need to be on the top. Okay. I think that it's possible for white people to actually, as the saying goes, give up their whiteness and become human again. And I, you know, like there are whole movements that are calling and critiquing whiteness, white racialized identity, or as I put it in the title of my book, The Machinery of Whiteness. Mm-hmm. They question it and they, you know, like look at it as being, you know, like their own self-dehumanization. And that realization comes along, you're going to have people who are going to move over and say, okay, I have to become an ally for this other diverse population. I can't stand and oppose to them. I can't stand as a colonialist, as a settler, against all these other people, you know, like who have a democratic right and have their own humanity to defend and to express. Okay, that's going to take a long time, and we're just sort of trying to figuring out right now. Okay, how do we address this culture of white supremacy? How do we begin to get people to see how they themselves, white people, are imprisoned in that white supremacy, and to an extent that those who are victimized by it are not. Those who are victimized by it have a greater freedom of operation, a greater freedom of who to be and how to be than the people who are dragooned and regimented into, you know, like the operations of this white supremacy. And, you know, like that was one of the things that started to come out of the massive demonstrations of the last summer, you know, right in the middle of a pandemic. You know, you had millions of people collectively out there in the streets saying, okay, stop killing us. Stop dehumanizing us. Stop all of this, and forming a new ethos of actually diversity, but black-led, brown-led, nothing wrong with that. It's because black people, brown people are the ones who are up against it. I can walk down the street, I'm not up against it. But when you get a demonstration, you know, like to say, okay, stop this brutality in this town, as the Cop Watch, you know, presentation showed, or, you know, like, stop killing black people. I'll be there, and I'll be marching in that march, and there'll be a lot of other white people who will be doing it too, along with me, and that is what we have to build on. Gradually, what this rebellion, and that's why I call it rebellion, is bringing about is a new ethos. It's a new ethos based upon a new ethic. And that is right there, the transformation of a cultural structure. saw it before, and it's going to happen, have to happen again, and it is happening again.
We're talking with Steve Martino. You mentioned that this will take some time. I don't have time, Steve. I need changes right now. And somebody listening to this would say, well, I actually don't feel like I have the freedom. I may be in touch with what I may understand to be my humanity, or I may actually be adopting the wave of the colonists. I may be adopting the wave of the oppressor. We definitely know that it's not freeing when I have to constantly switch code or feel that I need to do that. So, you know, as Danny Glover said in Boots Riley's movie, you know, I put on my white voice, the cop shows up, I make him feel less threatened. All these types of things some people would feel is imprisoning, you know. And so it sounds like a lot of people are imprisoned because of white supremacy. So the question becomes, this transformation that you're talking about, this new ethos, how can we hasten it? How can we quicken it and make sure that as people adapt it, that they're also willing to accept that it may come at a cost? It may mean that you're going to have to share some resources, that you may not be able to hold on to everything that you got. You know, I got a 5-bedroom house in the hills. It was on stolen land, literally, or I was able to get a loan while my neighbors couldn't. You know, maybe, you know, they may say there needs to be a correction. I'm not willing to make that correction. It wasn't my fault, Steve. I didn't do this. You know, that, you know, blame somebody else, but don't take away what I got. You know, I was innocent in this accruing of wealth or resources. Does this ethos come at a price, or can we have this realization and still bring everybody up so that they can be on an even playing field?
Well, two things. Mm-hmm. One is, yeah, I hear you, and still, it's going to take a long time. And you've been doing this kind of thing for years, and here we are. We're still talking about it. So what can we do to hasten it? What we're doing now. Statements like this, ideas being brought out, people in the streets, demonstrations about what needs to change, more and more people doing that. That's what we got. That's all we've got. Now, what are we up against? Yeah, these guys with the 5-bedroom houses up in the hills and things like that. What they have is things. What has made this entire system work for the last 250 years has been its reliance on consumerism. It's reliance on the ability to say you can buy anything you want here in this country that you can't do anywhere else in the world in the same way. This is the richest country in the world because it provides the most goods. And the ability to develop wage levels, salary levels, things like that, have been dependent upon this economy's ability to exploit other economies all over the world. Mm-hmm. So we are not only living on stolen land, but we are feeding ourselves at a level that is stolen from other economies. And of course, you know, like the closest element of this is Mexico, where, you know, like entire areas of Mexican agriculture has been destroyed by U.S. imports of cheaper agricultural goods to the point where Mexican farmers can't make a living, and so they come to the United States following their own money into this country to work for it, to send back home. And, you know, like what they're doing is a kind of a reparations process, you know, like with respect to the destruction of the Mexican economy. And it's going to take a while for them to figure it out. But that's where money comes for our ability to depend on consumerism. Now, this is big. This is really big because there's an economic structure there which is being used to keep people in line for the kind of corporatist, white supremacist system that runs the country. And it's bigger than us. It's got its own dynamic internationally.
Right.
And you see the United States fighting against that, you know, like tooth and nail, with the sanctions that it imposes on countries that don't agree or, you know, like try to establish a sovereignty for themselves in a different way than the United States wants to, you know, go along with. But it's big. And so, you know, like we are fighting a very, very big enemy. We're fighting a very, very strong force. And there is no way in the world that we can downplay that and say, okay, you know, like, well, we can carry on a class struggle and that'll, you know, like eventually straighten things out. No, we have to take seriously what we're up against and who we are, like contesting. And it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy.
Right.
There's nothing I can say or think, you know, like that's going to be, you know, like get past precisely the situations and the problems that you just laid out.
You touch upon some of this in an article called Cultural Roots of U.S. Interventionism. And you talk about that psychosis that, you know, exists when we go to these other lands and literally steal the economies. People may want to check that out. Steve, we're running out of time a little bit, and the topic du jour is this trial. What do you want people to take away from it? What two or three steps would you recommend that we, at this moment in time, undertake to maybe move in a direction that, in my opinion, in my desire, would hasten this ethos to come to come about? Or maybe it will move us in a direction that will weaken this powerful machine, this white supremacy. As we're consuming this trial, we're looking at it, we're thinking about it. What are two or three things that you would ask people to do moving forward?
Basically, I remember last May when it happened.
Right.
Okay, so Floyd was killed on May 25th. May 26th and May 27th, I remember, reportage of the event was that Floyd was in custody when Chauvin arrived with his team. He was standing there on the sidewalk with a cop holding on to him, and he was handcuffed. And Chauvin and his team came and they grabbed him and threw him on the street.
Right.
Killed him. Okay. That is being cut out of the trial. It's being made to look as if he was not in custody and it was Chauvin who was in charge of arresting him and he was resisting Chauvin. And that's why Chauvin had to, you know, like throw him on the street and hold him down. There's a fictionalization that is being perpetrated in this trial. So if I was going to say to anybody what to pay attention to, is to look carefully at the way in which things are fictionalized so that there is weight shifted over to the cops and away from what would be a sense of justice. And it happens all the time. And what happens, you know, we have political prisoners in this country who, you know, like have been framed by the cops and are still, you know, like being held in prison or, you know, like on death row or things like that. And what I think we should take away from this trial is simply the latest in event of how the ruling structure is going to try to minimize what is a clear example of egregious brutality that should never be, you know, like perpetrated on its own people by a government. And here the government is going to try to, you know, like clean it up. They're going to do their damnedest. And I really have no confidence as to what the decision of the jury is going to be. I don't. We've seen it, you know, like time and time again. And so the only thing that I can say to people about this trial is keep your, you know, like skepticism and cynicism at high order. Keep it in power because you're going to need it.
That is the voice of Instructor Emeritus of the Center of Interdisciplinary Programs at SF State. His name is Steve Martineau. I got it right now, didn't I? There we go. The French name, the T is not pronounced. You can see many of his writings. He's the author of the book, The Machinery of Whiteness. If you go to Counterpunch, he has Twisting the Law, Police Obedience and Racialization, The Police Use of Force and Berkeley's Use of Force, and The Killings Just Keep Going On are just some of the many writings. He also has a website that really breaks down many of his concepts. And I would encourage people to take a look. They're broken in, giving you the political history of racialization in the invention of whiteness, the political forms of racialization, the white supremacist state, the subjective structure of racialization in the U.S. And so there's a lot of information, a lot of science that can be gleaned from our guest this afternoon. Steve, thank you for joining us on Hard Knock Radio. We'll have to have you back where we can go a little bit deeper into some of these concepts, but we appreciate you weighing in on some of these things that are right in front of us today.
Well, thank you very much, Davey. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I really appreciate your having me on your show.
No doubt. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Last night, people protesting in Minneapolis escalated as demonstrators were lashed by tear gas and rubber bullets.
The main message here
is that they want to see those officers involved.
They want to see those officers arrested.
Trade my 4x4 for GC3, ain't no more free of street. I gave him chance and chance and chance again, I even told him please. I find it crazy the police to shoot you and know that you dead but still tell you to freeze. Nope, I seen what I seen, I guess that mean hold him down if he say he can't breathe. It's too many mothers just grieving, they killing us for no reason. Been going on for too long to get even. Throw us in cages like dogs and hyenas. I went to court and they sent me to prison. My mama was crushed when they said I can't leave. First I was drunk, then I sobered up quick. When I heard all that time that they gave to Talib, he got a life sentence plus. We just some products of our environment. How they gon' blame us? You can't fight fire with fire, I know, but at least we can turn up the flames on. Every color person ain't dumb, and all whites not racist. I be judging by the mind and heart, I ain't really in the faces. Know the way that we living is not getting better, you gotta know how to survive. Crazy, I had to tell all of my loved ones to carry a gun when they going outside. Stay in the mirror whenever you drive, overprotect and go crazy for mine. You gotta pay attention to the sign, seem like the blind following the blind. Thinking about everything that's going on, I boost security up in my home. I'm with my kind, if they right or they wrong. I call him now, he'll pick up the phone, and it's 5 in the morning, he waking up on it. Tell him wherever I'm at, then they coming. I see blue lights, I get scared and start running. Be crazy, they post to protect us. Swords and handcuffs and arrest us. Why they go home at night, they messed up. Knowing we needed help, they neglect us. One of them who gon' make them respect us. I can see in your eye that you fed up. Fuck around, got my shot, I won't let up. They know that we a problem together. They know that we can storm anywhere. That's bigger than black and white. It's a problem with the whole way of life. It can't change overnight. But we gotta start somewhere. Might as well go ahead and start here. We done had a hell of a year. I'ma make it count why I'm here. God is the only man I fear. I'm going on the front line, he gon' bust your ass if you come past that guy. shine. Now you know when the storm go away, then the sunshine. You got to put your head in the game when it's crunch time. I want all my sons to grow up to be monsters. I want all my daughters to show out in public. Seem like we losing our country, but we gotta stand up for something. So this what it comes to. Every video I see on my conscience, I got power now. I gotta say something. Corrupt the police been the problem where I'm from, but I'd be lying if I said it was all of them. I ain't do this for the trend. I don't follow them. Altercation with the law had a lot of them. People speaking for the people. I'm proud of them. Stick together, we can get it up out of them. I can't lie like I don't rap about killing and dope, but I'm telling my youngest to vote. I deal with I did, cause I didn't have no choice and no hope. I was forced to just jump in and go. This is all that we know, but it's time for a change. Got time to be serious, no time for no games. Ain't taking no more, let us go from them chains. God bless they soul, every one of them names. It's bigger than black and white. It's a problem with the whole way of life. It can't change overnight, but we gotta start somewhere. Might as well go ahead, start here. We done had a hell of a year. I'ma make it count why I'm here. God is the only man I fear. They training officers to kill us, then shooting protesters with these rubber bullets. They regular people, I know that they feel us. These scars too deep, they heal us. What happened to COVID? Nobody remember, it ain't making sense. I'm just here to vent. It happened to one of your people, it's different. We get it, the system is wicked, just learn how to pick it. Knowledge is power, I swear I'm a witness. I know that I'm gifted, I won't go too deep, cause I'm scared they'll get me. Ain't scared to admit it, some I can't mention. It's people who can, well here's the chance. I won't take the stand, but I'll take a stand for what I believe. Must not be breathing the air that I breathe. You know that the way that I bleed, you can bleed. I never been a fan of police, but my neighborhood know I try to keep peace. So it's only right that I get in the streets. March for a reason, I just on GP. How people die for us to be free. What do you mean? This was a dream. Now we got the power that we need to have. They don't want us with it, and that's why they mad. Yeah. It's bigger than black and white. It's a problem with the whole way of life. It can't change overnight, but we gotta start somewhere. Might as well go ahead, start here. We done had a hell of a year. I'ma make it count why I'm here. God is the only man I fear. It's bigger than black and white. It's a problem with the whole way of life. It can't change overnight, but we gotta start somewhere. Might as well go ahead, start here. We done had a hell of a year. I'ma make it count why I'm here. God is the only man I fear.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication leads to complication.
Bienvenidos a Radio Prensa Pobre. Welcome to Poor People's Revolutionary Radio. From the streets to the bus shelters. This is your co-host, Muteado Silencio, con voces de migrantes en resistencia, in studio today with Poverty Scala, Paul Poit, co-host, mi carnala, Tiny.
That's PNN, not CNN, people. And when you see that houseless mama and daughter sleeping in a tent, that means because we don't got money for the rent.
On today's Poor People's Radio, we will speak with Tony Robles from Manila Town Heritage Foundation and the ongoing struggle of the anti-Asian, anti-Black, anti-poor violence on this stolen land.
We are blessed to continue this conversation on this disgusting Americland trend of basically attacking our Asian brothers and sisters. And we know that didn't start yesterday. Actually, that's the sick part. Neither did anti-Black violence. Neither did anti-Brown violence or anti-Indigenous violence. This is what the stealing fathers built this stolen land on, pitting us against each other, fighting over the crumbs. And so this week, continuing that conversation, really looking at it from a different perspective, from a poverty scholarship perspective, because these are poor folks. These are folks who collect bottles and cans, who do sex work, and who hold on by a thread. And so this week, we have the blessing of inviting in one of the warriors from the Manila Town Heritage Foundation, the International Hotel, the site of land liberation of over 200 Asian disabled elders back in the 70s to take back that stolen land. The poet, the warrior, Mr. Tony Robles, welcome to Poor People's Radio.
Hey, how you doing?
So, yeah. You know, me and Moteado and another powerful poor fam, Weston, are here. You know, again, indigenous, poor, black and brown folk talking about the attack on our communities and our elders and our folks. This didn't start yesterday, and maybe you could help listeners lift up some of these his stories of our elders having to deal with this over the generations.
You know, from the time of the Chinese Exclusion Act to the Filipinos that had to deal with racism in California and throughout the West Coast, like you said, it is not new. It becomes almost ridiculous when people ask, why are there so many Asians here? And Jose Antonio Vargas put it very well. He says, you know, we're here because you were there. And quite frankly, it has to do with the history of colonialism, of domination, U.S. imperialism, which brought a lot of people here. And there's always been, I guess, scapegoating in times of economic trouble, this lashing out. And the fact that you have so many elders that are being attacked viciously on these streets, it's heartbreaking because with black, brown, black, yellow, third world liberation and solidarity, it's just heartbreaking that all the work that people like my uncle and Bill Sorrow and the San Francisco State strike, people that were working towards that, the solidarity and communities, seem to have been forgotten. But much love and much respect to those that are out there on the ground doing the work, like POR and a lot of individuals and a lot of people with different organizations that are really trying to push back. It really is hard. You know, myself, working in the public, and I work in retail, you know, it's up to us to talk to folks and to tell them, hey, you know, you need to have these conversations to keep your eyes open, because this is no joke. And the thing is, too, you know, there are certain people of color as well who buy into white supremacy, who in some ways, the biggest white supremacists of all, like the people of color that supported Trump. I mean, I hate to say that.
So could you tell listeners about some of the elders that you know who worked with Manila Town and dealt with this kind of trauma over the years?
Well, there were two in particular that come to mind. Freddie De Los Reyes was a Manong from the Ayo Hotel. Now, Manong, it's a term of respect for an older Filipino. It's like calling somebody an older brother. It's similar to the Spanish word hermano, hermano, manong, hermano. Freddie De Los Reyes, I think he was a merchant marine for many years. He was a musician. He was a banjo player. He played stringed instruments. And during the time of the Ayo Hotel, he was very active. And he was one of those Manongs who informed and touched and inspired my uncle to be the poet that he was. He was very, very old. I believe he was in his 80s when he was attacked. I think he was attacked in Chinatown. And this was back in the early to mid-80s, and it caused some really bad physical harm, and he just wasn't the same afterwards. There was another elder, Vicente Pascua. He was a newspaper vendor for the San Francisco Chronicle, I think it was. He used to sell papers in the morning, I think around Powell Street, and, you know, he was attacked and he was killed. Those happened a number of years ago, but the fact that they did happen, and a lot of the violence that's happened went unreported. And then you also have the issue of a lot of folks in the Asian community that aren't used to speaking out. The fact that these things are happening on the daily, I mean, you get online and you're seeing these things happening. It's just heartbreaking, and it can be demoralizing because it makes you feel helpless. Like, well, gosh, what do we do? What do we do?
I wanted to just insert a little bit here, because I think that the complex piece of this is that there's no perfect victims and there's no perfect perpetrators, meaning that when we were talking to Joe Wilson last week in Equipto, one of the things that we brought up was we've helped all kinds of Asian elders through the years, and they're also part of our community. Some of them are Hella Warriors and Auntie Ish and Gina Shibashi, Momi, so many more. And then there's poverty scholars like John Chan, who was facing eviction from his Poor People Section 8 housing for nothing, you know, basically because he had hoarder clutter illness. And the way to deal with that, of course, is to evict people and make them homeless. He was homeless on the streets for 5 years. And because of the shame around that, he never even told anybody. But long story, right? Hella poverty scholar, didn't even read, quote unquote, read and write, you know, from the linguistic domination way, even in his own language. Collected bottles and cans as a way to survive. Wakes up at 3 in the morning, gets on his rickety bicycle, and he's 75 years old. And that's what he does so he can eat. The whole time we're helping him, he's saying the N-word about the person that did this eviction of him, right? In other words, there's also this political correctness, weirdness, and expectation. And then there's also ignorance, let's be real, in our folks. I don't want to pretend that isn't there, because then we're also bull-ishing, right? That's real too. Profiling. And what's funny, because one of the things that came out for the youth today, because we had a really deep conversation, which actually kind of depressed them, really. It was really sad. But one of the things that came up for them was, yeah, there are some racist elders who follow me around in the store and profile me. And then there's other elders who are in the corner Chinese restaurant who've been knowing me since I'm a baby and always, you know, give me a kiss every time I come in and an extra, you know, an extra egg roll.
Yeah, so it ain't no one-size-fit-all thing.
And also, there's that piece about fighting over the crumbs, and the crumbs and the crumb snatch becomes the struggle instead of looking that we're all fighting over the same crumb.
And then whose oppression is more valid? Who's more deserving of this and that? When really you have somebody like Jeff Bezos who has made more money off this pandemic, the billionaire class got a lot richer at the expense of all this rhetoric and, you know, all the lashing out, and it's really poor people of color that have suffered the most. It's actually poor people of color. They're the ones that can't afford to do remote jobs. We're the ones that are working cash register and sweeping the floor and mopping the floor and, you know, having to deal with people that don't want to wear their mask and all that stuff.
I want to shout out to Sister Pearl Ubungin, who did a beautiful dance piece at Portsmouth Square the other day. It was a very healing, beautiful rally organized by Chinese Progressive Association in the city that Poor Magazine had the blessing of witnessing. Of course, Pearl is a great dancer anyway and a beautiful pianist, and Poor Family also. But it was very beautiful, and there was a lot of emotion and words there. Tone, do you want to close us out with a poem? Do you have anything you'd like to say or closing words as we close out?
Many of his poems were dedicated to the Manongs of the Eye Hotel. This is called Manong Felix. Dear Manong Felix, when I see your brown face, I see the rainforest of my people. Before white man's history, the Luzon mountain landscape clears my mind in the deep crevices of your ancient face. The Pasig River flows in Agbayani village. Your family was celebrating your life, Manong Felix. I see my tatai and nanai and ninong and ninang and anak and kapatid and lolo and lola in you. The chicken adobo smells good. I can taste the thick adobo tails of your life. Inside your small room, the rice is cooked. Your mata catches mine like a fishnet. My coconut body sways toward you. Watch the sun burst forth. And we know that Mutiado Silencio could relate to that poem when I was mentioning chicken adobo.
Yes.
All about Mutiado is all about the food, brother.
So much love, Tone. And I do want to let listeners know that right now Poor Magazine is working with Maniltown Eye Hotel to end the San Francisco Bayview baddest black newspaper in the Bay and beyond to do some street panels on this situation in both HP and Chinatown last weekend in April. We'll tune in for more information on that. We love you, Tone, and we'll be talking soon. Here's some upcoming poverty scholarship actions and liberations on these stolen streets. On Tuesday, April 20th, in the occupied village of Yalamu, Frisco, we have a powerful resistance to the ongoing stealing of poor people's housing, aka RAD and No Hope 6. As people know who are listeners, we have been resisting the non-profiteer housing developing of all of our poor people housing all across occupied Turtle Island. But now these non-profiteer and for-profit housing developers are making moves on all the last public housing in Frisco. Show up at San Francisco City Hall Tuesday, April 20th at 10 a.m. to listen to the voices and help folks launch their own tenants union, which is the only way to resist. Moving to
Saturday, April 24th at 1 p.m. in Hunters Point Bayview District at 3rd and Palou. Resisting, speaking up, loving up, and healing up from this continuing anti-Asian, anti-Black, anti-poor people violence. Again, at 3rd and Palou, there will be a powerful prayer, spoken word, an open mic, Saturday, April 24th at 10 a.m. And finally, on the Zoom streets, de-gentrifying academia from Uchin to Lenape, Oakland to Philly and beyond, moving and talking about landless people's land liberation, which is what we do at Homefulness every day in this stolen land. Shouts out to Segurite Land Trust, to Kashmir, people's movements, to our brothers and sisters from Pacific Island Scholars, to the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, and more. Again, that will be on Zoom at 3 p.m. on April 28th. So check in, check it out. And for more information on that, you can email poormag@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and listening up and loving up always.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication leads to complication.
So that's all for this segment of Poor News Network. If you want to hear any of our Poor People's Revolutionary Radio, you can subscribe to Poor Magazine SoundCloud channel or find and subscribe to Poor News Network on YouTube. Thanks to Anita Johnson, David D, and Anthony Fest for the media access, and all of you for listening. All power to the people.
Slipping up, look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping up. Don't catch you slipping up. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold like, yeah.
Hard knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN, at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris, Juwan, Kim, yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, you just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out to Anita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kind of crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on.
Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till they ready from the steel gray beef. Say please. Save you a seat at the table with a great bread, making a speech, saying peace to the lovers I made with a piece. Made a some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.